that usually it's not pertinent to say so, but I think in this occasion it is. There have been a number of attempts of scientists to intervene in the world of economics and finance and so forth. And one of them was a company called BIOS Group, which was the idea of Stu Kaufman, who's a theoretical biologist. And Stu had the idea of getting a bunch of people together, some in science, some in business, some in finance, some mathematicians, biologists, and physicists, and see if they could work together and invent ways to solve problems. And it was a lot of fun. One of the nicest parts of it was meeting Mike there, and I think he was, I learned more from talking to him about how the real world works than almost anything else. The company didn't succeed. It succeeded dramatically for a few years, and then it collapsed rather dramatically, which I think is sad. But in any case, during and since that experience, Mike has had occasion to try to get physicists interested in using the way that we think to solve problems in the real world, and he happened to be coming through Toronto and wanted the occasion, I've been trying to get him here for years, I should say, but he wanted the occasion to come and talk to us about how we physicists might intervene in the real world using what we know how to do. So, and people are still drifting in. You guys missed the introduction, but that's okay.
So first, I got to say that in my entire adult life, this is the first time I've ever talked to a room that's just scientists about what might be borderline science, and I'm terrified. So my topic is the best kept secret of economics. And economics is kind of an adjective magnet. You know, we have behavioral economics, which is like, why does my wife like Hermes scarves? And we have labor economics, which thinks about it in terms of jobs. And we have socioeconomics, which compares quote-unquote social values with stuff that emerges from economic systems and speculates about the differences. We have macro economics where guys troll stochastic lures through complex places in the economy and look for interesting patterns and tell us about discount rates and stuff like that. We have microeconomics, such as the land of supply, demand, price theory, golden hands, golden means, invisible hands. We have econometrics, which is kind of like macro, except they put the adjective on the back instead of the front of economics. And I'm not really an adjective guy, but if I had to use an adjective, I would say that it's more like physical economics. And so I needed someone to get this off my chest with, and I looked up physicist in the dictionary and said, you guys do physical stuff. And actually, there's a drumbeat of, and I'm not here to belabor any of these points, but there's a real growing awareness of how physical the economy really is. When you talk about peak oil and energy, I mean, unless I've been misled, these are physical measures, barrels and watts. The world has a water problem, which is constrained. That's a gallons measure. In the news twice this week. Started back here on Monday, we read about Atlantis running out of water. Maybe even New York has some problems. They gave us a day off the next day. Yesterday, San Diego was on fire, attributable in part to drought. So we got gallon issues. The world's food chain, that's a physical measure, calories. And it's actually pretty dependent on petroleum. I read the other day, half the world's nitrogen is now fixed artificially. Of course, the way you do that is use a bunch of petroleum to squash the nitrogen, and then you use some more petroleum to get the carbon. You make fertilizer, and then you drive the fertilizer to the farm, and they plant something, and then they take it from the farm. It goes four or five places, truck by truck by truck by truck, gets to a warehouse, goes to a supermarket, all truck, 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 and then you drive down and get it, take it home and eat it, more trucks. So they're burning more and more petroleum, and we got 6 billion people now doing all this stuff, and maybe 9 by 2050, if you believe those projections, and now the ice caps are melting, and climate's all screwed up, and we're wondering if we can continue to inhabit the globe. And then when we go and talk to economists and politicians and stuff about all this stuff, they're reviewing belief-based theories about how this all works. And actually, there's two little fabulous books. I don't know if you guys have seen Natural Capitalism by Amory Lovins, but it does a fabulous job with all the data and everything about problems with economic sustainability, and then turns immediately to belief-based, sweeping philosophical solutions to these physical problems. And Stu Hart and Capitalism at the Crossroads paints a little bleaker picture, which is it's the end of the economics as we know it today. We've got to somehow or other invent a whole new thing, but this era is over, and so forth and so on. I'm submitting to you that in the midst of this, we are ignoring the best kept secret in economics, which is the fundamental rules by which physical quantities and values behave in relation to one another in physical exchanges, and the empirical evidence for these rules in the aggregated economy. And I should have written in that slide, aggregated economies, because you see the same patterns irrespective of the belief system of the context of the economy. You see the same patterns in the Soviet Union, in communist China, in India, in Europe, in the United States, in Canada, in Latin America, and you even see them in Somalia. So it doesn't matter whether it's a terrible dictator or what, the data patterns are the same. Yes?
In that slide by values, I'm assuming you mean what I'm willing to pay for something rather than family values.
I'm going to have an exact slide on value in about three slides, but I mean arithmetic value with no adjectives. Okay. No adjectives. So arithmetic is the adjective that means no adjective. So I actually asked Bruce Sawhill, who's a physicist friend from BIOS, for some, you know, I said, how should I talk to these guys? I would like to invoke Occam's razor, and will they be offended if I don't do it in Latin? He said, go ahead, you can use English. And so, I mean, you guys know this stuff better than me. This is our favorite 14th century Franciscan monk, William of Ockham, brown robe, Jesuits had the black robes. And he was a philosopher and a theologian and a scientist, and perhaps best known in science for the idea that an explanation of a phenomenon should make as few assumptions as possible and eliminate those that don't make any difference in the predictions of the underlying hypothesis. Actually, Bruce suggested you should just use its nickname, and these guys will understand exactly what you mean. I said, what's that? He said, it's called ontological parsimony. So if that connects us, maybe we're connected. So if you talk about razors, you start to think about errors, and ontological parsimony certainly helped lead us to finding fairly basic explanations for a whole lot of stuff: natural selection, general relativity, special relativity, quantum physics, fluid dynamics, and the list goes on. And we know that even extraordinarily complex systems like the weather still emerge from quite simple initial explanations. So I'm not a weather guy, but I tried to read up on this a little bit before I came, and we had these Navier-Stokes equations. And we've had them since 1836 for a century and a half. And there's lots of GCM models and other stuff in the weather. None of them ignore these equations. They may not get perfect predictions in their model, but they don't do it without Navier-Stokes. And so I'd say, warning, ignore these basic rules at your peril. There's this mad monk out there in a brown robe with a razor shaving errors, and they could be ours. Okay, shaving's changed since 1400. If Ockham was here, we could give him an electronic razor. And this, of course, is no surprise to you guys either. We have these fabulous new computers, and we can do lots of complicated modeling and stuff. And despite that, still we accept that some things are simply uncomputable. And I put on there so far, in case any of you guys are working on quantum computing or some of that, to blow the lid off of these constraints. But at the moment, we accept as a practical matter that some things are uncomputable. And maybe one of favorite examples is the MP hard traveling salesman problem and things of that nature. And this, of course, means that very complex systems like the weather and the economy, cited often as favorite examples, are sort of the only complete models of themselves. So let's take a look at the record here for economic modeling. Back in the late 80s, when I was just joining the NASDAQ stock market board, the Brookings Institute studied the 12 major macroeconomic models then in use. And it was a nasty report. They essentially concluded that none of them were usefully, quote unquote, usefully predictive. It was sort of blown for the modelers. And the central bankers loved it. and they warmed up their philosophy and revisited their belief-based principles, and that's basically how they go about setting discount rates and deciding what to do about the subprime meltdown. So famous economists like Milton Friedman said, macroeconomy is too complex to be predictably modeled and managed. And during my era, perhaps the most famous oracle and master of credulity in my lifetime, Alan Greenspan, testified at Congress that to essentially the same effect, too complex for the models to really be useful. These guys are very persuasive, and so sometimes even very clear-headed scientists start to feel sorry for him. I think David Orrell in Vancouver might be an example of this. He's an absolutely fabulous weather guy who specializes in model errors. The weather guys were sort of, you know, it's too complex for the models to be predicted, but our models are great. It's the computation thing that's the problem.
Can I back you up just a second? What is a belief-based model?
A belief-based model is one that starts with a belief and doesn't believe, you know, instead of empirical testing. Religion is a belief-based model.
Okay.
So anyway, he felt sorry for the economics guys, I guess, and sort of swept them into the same thing. This is a fabulous book, by the way, The Future of Everything. He says, you know, we run into the same problems. The system's uncomputable. We have to have parameters. The more we refine, the more parameters, accurate predictions remain elusive. However, that sort of populist source by who knows who about virtually every topic, Wikipedia, is less kind to the economics guys. And they say comparison of the two shows the present state of economic modeling in a very unflattering light. This whole dialogue obscures Occam's simple question for those of us who would presume to hypothesize. But have you sharpened your best razor and sought the simplest hypothesis? And if so, economists, what are the Navier Stokes equivalents in economics? Yes.
So I think is it a little unfair to characterize belief based as like the way that you just did? I mean,
probably
would it be a little more fair to say that they have heuristics that they're trying to apply?
Let's say heuristics then.
Okay.
I'm a big believer in heuristics. I have
two
different companies based on heuristics.
I guess my point is they're not totally unmotivated.
But when you take an idea like economic capitalism and call it your economic system, that's sort of belief-based, and then there's a whole population of heuristics that move around inside that space. So, yeah, I probably overreached there. I stand corrected.
Quick question?
Yeah.
In light of the Wikipedia comment here, and back in Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, they brought in this whole Social Security thing, and he hired a couple of economists to predict roughly what, you know, population was going to be. And as I understand it, they actually did a fantastically good job of predicting the rise and fall of the Social Security Trust Fund.
They did.
Throughout the past 100 years, you can make a pretty good prediction the stock market's going to continue to go up when course-grading over 10-year periods at a pretty steady rate of, you know, 80% or something like that. In light of those predictions and the fact that we have no ability to predict the weather more than a month in advance, is that really a fair, it seems like this is missing the fact that there have been some really pretty good long-term predictions.
There's been some good stuff.
Yeah,
I didn't mean it to be fair. Actually, I meant it to be real.
Yeah. Next year there will be winter. It's really easy. It's really easy.
I actually meant to be on the edge of
the
roof.
But not going to be such a temperature on the 15th of January 2023, right?
So anyway, I'd say this raises a question, kind of scientific model we use to help define the simplest hypothesis for the emergence of an economy, yes or no. And I'm here to say, in a sort of hobby shop, fairly rough, simple way, I'm going to try to show you the answer to that question might be yes, which of course raises the question, how do we know if any model actually produced an economy? If you go back to 1777, we've got this guy Gauss, who was a fabulous guy and made huge contributions to statistics, and he gave us this kind of happy thought of called the bell curve, and he heard the probabilities in here under the bell curve, and they all know what to do, and they line up under the middle, and it's sort of a big, happy space in the middle. And it had a profound impact on economic philosophies. For example, Adam Smith said that, you know, this happens because of an invisible hand, and all you have to do is just leave the markets free and you get everything clumps up under the golden mean. And Karl Marx said you get the same result by doing exactly the opposite thing, which is manage it from the top down and have the state own it all. Yeah, but it would then, you know, in turn result in the golden mean. And this has had a long two-century lasting effect on economic and particularly political economic thinking. And of course, the problem is these pesky power law things, and you guys know more about these than me, but specifically in economics, things appear in power law patterns. The probabilities don't go sit in the middle where they're supposed to belong in a Gaussian world. It's true for currencies, like up there at the left, that used to be the dollar plus a couple of days ago when I left. And it stays sliding down fast, and you know, and you get the euro, and Canadians are on there, and you come on down under the knee of the curve. If you're interested in the Thai baht, for example, it's way over there under the right. The same thing's true for individual wealth.
So, when so you mean the amount of money in different currencies? Is that what you're?
Yes. If you measure the amount of currency in use, if you measure the number of firms using the currency, you'd be surprised at the number of things that give you the same power law. You know, to disaggregate the data. Power law just resonates out there, and these things seem to snap onto it, you know, empirically. Individual wealth is measured in dollars. You got Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, those guys up to the left. The rest of us, if we're lucky, down and around the knee of the curve someplace, and you've got some poor soul in Somalia or the drought-laden South Africa under the tail end. This is true by firms, for firms. By size, by any measure of firm size, whether you count them by headcount, by cap value, in various ways, you get a power law distribution of firms. When you sprinkle the firms in the economy, you'd cities apply that way too if you chose to think of them as economic entities and so forth and so on.
What is the y-axis here?
That's the up and down one. Depending on the example, that's the, depending on the example, in currencies that size to float, and individual wealth, that's dollars or euros or whichever currency you pick to measure it in. In firm size, the most common way of doing that is by equity. So what you've got up here at the left by firms is Walmart and General Electric, and maybe Microsoft, and then you have a vast number of small entities sprinkled out. Under the bottom.
The horizontal axis in that case would be the number of.
This is the number of currencies, the number of people, the number of firms, the number of cities, etc.
So you're ordering them by, like, revenue, say, for example, for firms, right? Is this correct?
The exponents are a little different depending on what you put on the axis, but they essentially lie on the power law.
Right. And this is, but I mean, Not every physicist has been through Santa Fe and did a propagandized approach. So, for example, for a city size, if you list the cities in a country in order, and you ask what's the, take the largest city and call it one, you know, New York, then the second city is half of that, the third city is a third of that, the fourth city is a fourth of that, and so forth.
Actually, it's true in every country in the world except Russia and Moscow. Is the pattern slightly different in Moscow, and probably a little bit because it was so centrally managed. The guy that really evangelized this was actually Per Bach that you were talking about earlier when we were down at BIOS.
Sorry, before you flip on?
Yeah.
So in the previous slide, you put up a bell curve,
mm-hmm.
where the up and down axis here is probability,
mm-hmm.
and the horizontal axis is maybe dollars or something. And now we've got a power law curve,
mm-hmm.
where the up and down axis is now city size or number of dollars, and the horizontal axis is, you know, first richest, second richest, third richest. And I got the impression that one of these was supposed to kind of, you know, that this was supposed to contradict the idea that things are Gaussian distributed or something, but I'm not clear on why that is. Can you make explicit?
There's a lot of reading on it. A lot of things are Gaussian, like if you say what's the average weight in the room, you can get a pretty normal, you know, distribution around the median. How tall are people? If you put up a black curtain and there's two people behind it, and I just say to the guys in the room, okay, there's two people in here, total height is 12 feet, you know, total weight's 350 pounds, guess how much for each one? Almost nobody guesses, oh, sure, that's an 11-footer and a 1-footer. And, you know, that's a 300 pounder and a 50 pounder because they know that, you know, that's a Gaussian distribution. If you ask the same question about an entire room full of corporations, the corporate, you don't get a standard distribution, you get a power law distribution.
So they do contradict each other, and a way to say it is that, so if, I don't know, pick whatever one of those you want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
City size, somewhere there's an average city. There's a city which has the average size. Okay. And if you convert this to a distribution of the number of cities in each region, larger or smaller than the average size, you will not get a Gaussian. And the difference is that the tails, well, you can...
It's got algebraic tails.
It's got algebraic tails.
Yeah, okay. Power law implies algebraic tails.
Fat tail curves.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I get in trouble on this. I shouldn't have used graphs. Okay.
So what it means is that the tails are much larger than you would have thought in Gaussian distributions. Okay. So there are many. Yeah.
There's a fabulous provocative book on this, on, you know, called The Black Swan by Haseem Taleb, who's a famous bond trader, and he's written about, there's actually a bunch of other stuff out here you could worry about too, strange attractors and Mendel-Brochen phenomenon and stuff like that, but this is more simple. I'm trying to stick with Occam here. So I would say, whoops, what happened to the bell curve? And so actually, I think Paris...
Question?
Yeah.
Isn't that a lot to do with correlated behavior? Like, if I gave a test to everybody in this room and they couldn't cheat, I would get a bell curve. And then if I let everybody cheat off everybody else, I would get some kind of cooperative curve with power law fails.
I'm not sure how to answer a question to those kinds of complex things, because I'm trying to deal here just with the fact that if you look at it a lot of different times, you see the same pattern over and over and over again. And then if you're going to answer why, you've got to have some kind of a theory, and it might have a lot of branches in it and get very complex. And at the end, you might go, I understand the theory, I understand the result, and I can't explain in one why. You know, why I'm having this result.
The bell curve, there are times where you can prove it'll come up, like you have a central limit theorem.
Yeah.
So, but then you need some very specific conditions, which are almost never true in the real world scenario. Yeah.
Well, I may be wrong here, but.
But you also get power laws occurring in things like earthquakes if you measure the size of a tremor.
Right.
I think you could probably, I'm not absolutely certain, I'm sure you can make some sort of argument that if you looked at lots and lots of different planets that all had some sort of geological activity, so they weren't, you know, causally connected to each other in some seismic sense, that you would still find if you compared the scale of tremors with how often they happen, you'd get a power law.
Maybe we can postpone this discussion.
Give me power laws, and I'll show you how to get them, and then let me come back, and maybe we were doing the wrong thing. You know, I could be doing a complete wrong thing here, and I'm very open to that. So, well, actually, unfortunately, Fair died. He was interested in this as well. But Bruce Sawhill, who's a physicist from Santa Fe, and Jim Harry, who's a computer scientist, they're proposing the minimum test for a model of a real economy was very simply then one that would produce emergent money with currencies and power law distributions, and one that would produce economic entities in power law distributions. And while such a model might be way, way, way short of any kind of a complete explanation of anything, if you can't explain these minima, despite the fact that you see them in all these economies, despite whatever the prevailing context around the economies is, then at least you would think it's a non-starter, and it'd be good to get this simple stuff taken care of first, you know, before we make things more complex. And so we started building a model in 1999, and now I'm going to show you exactly how we built the model, which is where I could get in trouble. So we started off with these things we call particles. And so you could imagine some, and I've just said letters form here, A, B, C, we actually use numbers in the model, but that letters are a little easier, I think, intuitively. And imagine transformations of particles. So if you have an A and a B, it transforms to a C. And if you have a D and an E, it goes to an F. And you have some that go the other way, so you don't lose any particles. You want to count them while they're running along through the model. And the particle sort of less than everything small enough so you have enough of them to work with. So, I mean, I have to be, you could think very small if you wanted, like a molecule, an atom, or a quanta, or whatever you guys have shaped this down to. You've got a bunch of smaller stuff now, imagine. But if you want an economic metaphor, you could think of a bigger particle, and you could go like cheese plus egg is an omelet, or an omelet, and coffee is breakfast, and so forth and so on, like that. So each one of those is just for purposes of this model. The particle abstraction represents pretty much whatever you want to think of, as long as it's something that might be exchanged in the economy. And of course, you start having fun with this, and you can think of 37 A's and 29 B's equals 1.34 times 10 to the second C's and all kinds of common part possibilities. But for right now, let's say what we worked with was one of this, and one of that is one of something else.
You said they're conserved or not? Did you say at the beginning that they're the total number
is conserved? Yes, the total number is conserved. So here's this model. These particles come down a chute. They go through this little transformation sorter. We randomly assign them transformations, and we don't let anything out of the sorter that's not in a transformation sort. And we let those out so that the particles are conserved. Okay, so now, next imagine an agent, okay? So by this I mean an agent that can act on its own behalf, that is associated with a simple transformation possibility, and that can exchange particles with other agents. Again, it could be various sizes. You know, it could be an amoeba, it could be an alga out in the ocean, transforming sunlight and carbon dioxide and turning it into green goo. We had a fisheries guy for a while, so I put fish in there. It could be a fish. It could be someone sitting next to you. It could be Microsoft. You might think that's more complex transformation, strains the metaphor. Actually, it doesn't actually strain it as much as you might think, but I'm not going to argue that point here. And I'm going to say, just for anthropomorphic flavor, let's just call this first agent Bingo. And define Bingo. This is her transformation sequenced over time. A plus B transforms into C. And let Bingo repeat this. We call it her metabolism successively. So this is her life. She takes an A and a B, or B and an A, and makes a C and does it again. Okay. The next thing, of course, is that due to sequence, Bingo can't be in all possible physical states at once, and we can write those down. So she could be in certain, in terms of her particles, she could be an A or B, or she could have an A and a B, or she could have a C. And again, to simplify things, we just said let A and B occur. I use the word there immediately. So the model's ticking along, tick, tick, tick. If she starts with an A, tick, she gets a B. Next tick, she's a C. So if we skipped, if you're using the omelet metaphor, we're not warming up the pan, sprinkling out the spices, having a sip of wine, checking the cookbook, going back, thinking about what else we might want to put in the omelet. You know, when you add the cheese there, you put that egg on the table, bang. And if you were a finance guy, we'd just say we've simplified this by taking out the inventory case. Okay, so in financial terms, that's the inventory case. And so now...
But isn't time also a resource in a way? Kind of something you need to do things?
This is a big thing. It's a big thing in here. And on that, we did this, you know, tick, 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 sequenced out like that. And there are some places in here where we spent about 6 months just totally torturing our heads about time. And actually, I can show you here in about just a few slides where that came up and made it confusing for us. But at this state of the game, we needed to get started. So, and we did this randomly in the model. So pick a physical state to start it. And if you guys go with A, that's what I used to make these slides up. So now we have Bingo, physical state A. And then here comes the next problem. We defined her as, in terms of this transformation, and if we want to represent A at the, in terms of this definition of Bingo, then we need some way to say not stuff. We have to be able to say, to start with, we have to be able to say not B and not C for Bingo. So we said, let these, we call them whatnots, let these whatnots be represented here by primes. So now Bingo's got an A. She knows that she can transform A's and B's into C's, and she's got these primes that allow her to say yes or no as to whether she has any one of the three particles in her physical state. Okay, and so we can say we have an equation of sorts. We can take A plus not B equals not C, that's where bingo is. And we can imagine three other possibilities. Actually, that first one is physical B, that second one is physical C, and that last one is having doesn't have any of those, which might happen if she got rid of her C for something that wasn't an A or a B, and was wandering around in the model getting ready to get physical again, and looking for an A or a B. So that so there's actually four possibilities here. Yeah.
Can I just see if I understand the, I don't know if this will help other people, but so in the model there's lists of stuff. There's 49 A's, 562 B's, some number of C's, and so forth. And they're existing in some reservoir. And then there's a number of different agents, and each agent has some rules they're able to do. They're able to take, for example, her thing. And then, and so the state of the model is the states of the agents, which you've been describing.
Correct.
Okay. Plus, there may be some things out there which are not under control of any agent.
Well, there's the only there's no particles that are under agent control.
Okay.
But all the particles necessary for every transformation statement are under some agent control.
Okay. So the model is a list of agents and what they control.
Correct.
Okay. And correct. Then they. Okay.
Exactly. So is your reservoir just a trivial agent that doesn't do any transformation?
No, there's no trivial agent. Well, actually, at one point of cheating to make sure stuff was right, which I'll show you in a few slides, we did cheat for a temporal moment as a sort of model test, and then we took that out and started to grapple with what next. But the pure idea is just agents and these particles are assembled in these transformations, and we stick them in the model and get it going.
Two quick questions.
Yeah.
One is, could bingo possibly have two A's? Could you be keeping around an extra one?
Not the way we did it.
And
no.
could there be an agent that takes a C and splits it into an A and a B?
There is. They have to go both ways. So, exactly right.
I have one other question. So,
yeah.
I guess the last two equations there, I mean, maybe I don't understand something, but it says A prime plus B prime equals C, and the other one says A prime plus B prime equals not C. Right? But, I mean,
I got the prime on the wrong one there. No, I'm right. This is B, this is C. These went away as soon as she got them, and she turned into C. And this is, she doesn't have any of those three, but she could have other stuff. There's a lot of different things that meet the condition of not three things, right?
So are those just... The equal signs there, should I sort of ignore those and just treat those as possible states? Like the last one says she doesn't have any of the particles, and the one above that says she doesn't have an A or a B, but she does have a C?
Well, I read it like this, and maybe, you know, I'm not an arithmetic guy, so maybe this arithmetic isn't right, although this is the arithmetic we used in the model. This top one up here, she's physical A, this next one she's physical B, this next one she's physical C, and this next one she's something else that isn't one of those three things.
Okay, so those are not actually equations.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they are if you think about the transformation state. It gets worse. Okay.
But hang on, can I maybe, would it maybe be fair then to say that the agent is actually classified by three labels, which are A, B, and C, which can have any one of those labels can have the value yes or no.
Correct.
Okay. And when you're talking about a transformation, what you're actually doing is saying that it's automatic that if the agent is in state A equals yes, B equals yes, C equals no, that at the next time step should be in the state
yep.
B, A
exactly.
No, B equals no, C equals yes.
Okay. Very quick. Very quick. So we don't have any numbers here yet, and then we'd like to measure, because if you look at the economy, there's lots of numbers, and if we don't have numbers, this isn't going to look like an economy. So measure, we need to do something. So we need to think about value, and we need to think about a unit of measure. And here's the value point that was asked earlier. I was saying only arithmetic value, which is just a number and a decimal digits, data item, maybe a sign, maybe an exponent, maybe a scaling factor. And I'm absolutely not by any stretch of the imagination talking about anything that has anything to do with economic value, which is a theory of everything encompassing all the theories that might purport to explain the exchange value of price of goods and services. So I'm sort of saying arithmetic is the prime for adjective, no adjectives. So I'm not, this doesn't have anything to do with quote unquote true value. And it certainly doesn't have anything to do with what notions like fair market got.
The last transparency, was that a NAND gate?
Was it which?
NAND, not A and not B. It's the only thing that gives you a one in electronics.
Well, we haven't been with this because
everything turns into these goofy things.
1 equals 0, yes equals no, 0 equals 1, and so forth. You know, it only takes about 4 steps to slam right into this dizzy problem.
Okay, so forget I was wrong.
Okay, so that's what this about value. So I'll just talk about a unit of measure for bingo. And so she only knows 6 possible things that she could use for a unit of measure now. Yes A, yes B, yes C, no A, no B, no C. Those are the 6 things that she has any knowledge of whatsoever. So if she's going to measure and do simple, like Occam suggested, she has to really know the most efficient thing to do would be to pick 1. And so, and those are the possibilities, and anyone will do. In fact, I wrote a little book of starting with physical ones to try to sort of show how money evolved in early economies. But the abstraction path is a little simpler if you go from the prime, so if you'll just give me that for the minute, pick anyone randomly, and I said pick C. So she needs this to say yes or no. About C, if she's going to measure everything in here in terms of C, she's got to be able to have values for C, and she's got to be able to say yes or no about C. So those are the 2 conditions for measurement. So for that reason, if we're going to use equations, she's going to need 2 more units of measure for just counting what we allow her to have. And anytime she gets more than she needs, we're trying for the minimum case. We're going to, you know, try to shave that back off. So she needs 2 more to measure with. And I've just put a little sub 2 on those 2 C prime units so we can keep track of our abstraction layers. And so we've abstracted twice now, once to say no and once to measure. Okay, so now we go back and we want to be able to measure this and things in this transformation process as we go along. So it'd be nice to do A and B in terms of C. That's the thing we're trying to measure. We know that these things we abstracted are all equal to one unit. And therefore, we can say that any value in terms of this new abstraction for A and B needs to be between 0 and 1, because if we make A or B 1, then we have B or A 0, and if that's 0, then there can't be any C, and the transformation process collapses, and bingo, disappears in smoke in the collider. So we basically just randomly assign values between 0 and 1 to A and B in order to initiate the agent bingo. And I would say just for purposes of this, let those be 0.5 each, 50-50 for this first agent. So I'm going to say 0.5 C prime, so 2 over A, and 0.5 over B.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Can you just flip back? So I'm sorry, but I just got completely lost, and I'm trying to find myself. The third line says we know that 1 C equals 1 C prime equals 1 C prime 2. Now, I seem to remember that C means I've got a C particle, and C prime means I don't have a C particle. So that line confuses me a lot.
That's why it's a paradox. That's exactly why it's a quantum paradox, and it happens in that very first economic steps that you take to build the simplest models. You crash right in head on into paradox. And that's also why I'm showing you guys through this. I'm going to show you the arithmetic of how the model actually runs. And I practice it on a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old. And they get it instantly, as long as I skip this part where you hit the paradox. If I put that in, then almost everybody falls off the horse before a backstretch, and nobody gets to the finish line because they want to go back and undizzy over the paradox.
So you're saying I shouldn't look at this slide?
No, I'm saying notice the paradox 1.5 slides before I was going to declare it.
But can you rephrase what you're saying is kind of you're counting your amount of certainty about C
if you have a C or a not C, you're certain about what you've got. If you have an A, you're not sure whether you have a B or not, so you're not sure how much C you have.
Well, there isn't any C. If you have an A and you can't get a B, there isn't any C, as far as you're concerned. You're a dead agent at that point, you know?
I think he's not quite interpreting. So what you mean by value is you're going to assign a function that, given the state of the agent, gives you a number.
Right.
And the number is in units that you're calling C2.
Correct.
Just to give them a name.
Right.
Okay. And you have a rule that assigns this number to the six different states.
Right, randomly. But as long as we don't collapse the transformation possibility by, they have to add up to one.
Right.
If we, so we don't take away the transformation policy. And then they all start with a random start. Just randomly make these numbers between 0 and 1 up, so.
So, fine.
I don't know why you call it paradox. It's pretty trivial. If you have, you know, you have one C, it means it's not a C prime, right? So.
It gets worse. See, maybe you'll convince me it's not a paradox, but I think it gets worse. Two slides and it's way worse. It is a paradox.
Formally, what you're doing is you have a model. There's a bunch of agents. The agents have states. The rules that determine what states they can have, and rules of transformation in time.
Right.
And now you have associated with each agent a function which given any state of the agent gives you a number valued in something that you defined here, you call it C2, and you have a rule which assigns randomly or however the values of that function to the states of the agent.
Right, there's a starting state. It's a value hypothesis at this point. It's not tested in any way, but you need a starting state to get going.
That's not a divided by then. That just means A has, is at 0.5 C2 prime?
Well, you can think of per.
Okay.
Yeah. I see. You get the same paradox when you divide or multiply.
But
it comes out the same way either way, no matter.
So it's really a notational question.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is my first experience with notation in my adult life, because when we built this model, Bruce did the notation. I just passed out the pizza and wine.
One simple question. The value you assign to B has to be 1 minus the value you assign to A?
Correct.
So since we're still here, I just want to make sure something. I now understand that third line to mean that the value of a C is one unit of C2 prime.
Correct.
And the value of a C prime is also one unit of a C2 prime.
Correct.
But that doesn't mean that a C is equal to a C prime. It just means they have the
it's
same
opposite.
Value.
But they have the same value. Value, but they're opposite.
Yeah. Sure. Fine.
So this is where a funny thing happens on the way to the form. Because if you can say all those things that we just said, 1, 1, 1, this is the value point. You made it better than I did by far. You can also say that you can have an equation that looks like this. You can say 1 C prime sub 2 over C equals 1 C prime sub 2 over C prime, given that you're accepting the fact of the paradox that C equals not C prime. And, you know, your first instinct is to get your pencil out and slice away all the different things that are equal to one another and see what it collapses to. And it collapses pretty fast. If you leave it exploded like that, keeping just physical track of the units that you've used, both physical and abstract, then you have a situation where you could look at this and say, gosh, in this little statement, the numerators are units of measure, and one unit is simply a denominator for counting yes or no. And that actually might be quite practical, were it not for the fact that you have 1 equals 1, 1 equals 0, yes equals no, and all the rest of this stuff. And you're trying to build this model, and you might imagine us going back to Father Occam. You know, we're saying we're trying to keep this simple, Father, but equal and opposite is confusing. And Father Occam might say, accept uncertainty, my children, and proceed practically with thy best razor in hand. And we might say, yes, Father, and get past this paradox. Or we might seek more current solace from someone in your field, where Niels Bohr wrote, how wonderful that we've met with a paradox, because now we have some hope of making progress. And we do, because money is, by definition, a paradox. Money is defined, and has been for about 100 years, if you look back into the oldest dictionaries you can find, as a common major, that's what our two units were, that also serves as a unit, one more unit, of exchange. There's a big and in money. And we may thus say, without straining our heads too hard, that the simple act of abstracting enough stuff to major a single physical parter represents a single currency hypothesis. We haven't met the test of common, because this is true for every particle in the model. But if we measure the particles in the model in the simplest way we can, it automatically represents a currency hypothesis, which is pretty cool. And it does leave the question of how the hypotheses compete to pass this third test of commonality. So now let's go back and look at Bingo. She's in physical state A. She's got this physical A. I'm just counting the units, you know, to be careful. Three abstracted units, one C prime and the two C primes. She needs, now I'm just going to see what she uses up doing the stuff she has to do to get going here. She uses up 0.5 of that measure, so to measure the A, because that's what we just made up. It might be different for, depending on which random state in the individual agent started in. So she's got 1.5 left. She needs 1 for the other side of an equation if she's going to have an equation. So now she has 0.5 left. She has 1 unit of C prime for counting yes or no with. And we can therefore write this. 0.5 C prime sub 2 over A plus 0.5 C prime sub 2 over C equals 1 C prime sub 2. And that is a very fun thing to be able to write down, because now Bingo can hold an analyst call. And I'd say to make it just a little simpler in the notation, forget the sub stuff now. And we're just saying we're using numerators are measures and denominators are units. So, you know, essentially we're saying if it's money doing all this abstract stuff, and you're interested in if you have something or not, it's useful to be able to say yes or no. That's what we're using that bottom denominator. And that is a good thing, because if the answer is no and you're trying to buy lunch, you're kind of hurting a little bit. And now she has what we call a balance sheet. And if, you know, it's on, the call goes on, she's in front of the analyst, I have cash, they go, we never heard of this, you're the only one with this hypothesis. She might have to be a little blurry on her first analyst call, you know, until this gets a chance to test commonality a little bit. She has what we call an inventory of A, and 0.5 leads that up to what we call equity. And this equation is at least 5,000 years old in common usage. Anthropologists showed us evidence of this equation in use in Mesopotamia in the Fertile Crescent on the same clay tablets that were used to invent writing and first anthropological indications of the use of arithmetic. There is an outlier group that thinks the Incas did it before the Mesopotamians, using not clay tablets but knotted strings, but it's pretty clear it was the same equation in South America. Chinese recently readjusted history to suggest that they maybe did this before either the Incas or the Mesopotamians, but that doesn't have a lot of big deal academic support in anthropological circles. But this has been used for at least 7,000 years. And so we can actually make this thing. A money hypothesis. Found a wireless net. And a financial statement are co-emergent from the simplest requirements of physical measurement. We can make that statement. It doesn't cause too much angst. And it's actually pretty simple. Kind of the funny thing about it is they never used in economics and been just laying there under everybody's nose. 7,000 years. Okay, so now let's run the model a little bit. So Bingo's looking for a V. So imagine her going in the metabolic particle collider, and she's got her transformation statement, her hypothesis for currency, her initial balance sheet. And I don't know how you may imagine she's got a purse or something, big strappy purse. Here goes Bingo into the collider. And her question for each agent encountered, of course, is, hey there, you got V. So the collider is a little bit like a Bingo machine, you know. I don't know if you guys ever did this. The lady with the blue hair up front turns a crank, the balls bounce around, and she stops one spot, pulls one out, and shouts out a matrix location, 27 across, you put it on your cart. And I'm going to cover the matrix in a minute, but it's sort of an etymology of a bingo, and B, she may not be the only one looking for B. For example, Georgette might be in there. She's B transforms into R plus W. There's one that goes the other way. And maybe she's got a different purse, so you can keep track of the difference between Georgette and bingo and whatnot. And the agents begin colliding from a random start. And then when they do a first successful encounter, we use a little pointer so they can find their way back. And Harriet named it a pheromic pointer, like ant pheromones. You know, the ant goes out and looks for food and finds it. He leaves her pheromone back. And then the other guys sniff the trail, and they keep going until food's gone, and then do a random thing. Except this is this trail is a little bit strange metaphor. It goes the other way. This is how bingo finds her way back to where she had the successful encounter. And so now you could maybe think she's like, imagine her with a bottle of Chanel number 5 in her purse. And now, so now bingo meets Max, and he's P plus Q transforms into B in physical state B, and he's thinking in B prime, so we need to make up a couple more numbers to go back and figure out how Max was instantiated. So picking 2, and I said 0.4 and 0.6. And the agents can do regular arithmetic, so Max can figure out that Q over P is 1.5 and so forth. And he has the same stuff as bingo, maybe in a wallet, no purse. And so now imagine an exchange. And I'm going to brush exchange and finish a couple cycles in the model and then come back to exchange a little better. So I'm going to gloss exchange right now. But they do have Harriet did most of the naming, haggle. And bingo exchanges 0.4 units of her C prime for Max's B. You might say, well, Max never heard of C prime. This is exactly this first earliest bump between agents in the model where we have a transfer of primitive knowledge. And I'll come to why later, but Max is programmed to try it the first time it's proposed rather than doubt it. So he's programmed to be open to new knowledge. And all the units are just traded with arithmetic. So, you know, bingo gave up 0.4, she subtracts. Max gave up a B, he subtracts. Bingo adds B, Max adds the C prime. And this haggle's a little if-then thing, which I'll come to a minute. Now, bingo just does this arithmetic. In units of C prime, she started with 0.5, gave Max 0.4. She's got that left. And in measures, she was measuring A at 0.5. She just paid Max 0.4, so she measures that at 0.4, and now she says, I got 0.9 C prime over C, and she's got an updated balance sheet. She can have another analyst call. So now she's got cash at 0.1, inventory at 0.9, and the equity at 1. The equity is still the same. Hasn't changed. Yeah. So now it's, you know, home to, you know, back in the saddle again, get bingo back in the collider and do another cycle. She hasn't completed her transformation cycle yet, and I'd like to get that done, so just without worrying about the other agent, imagine now she exchanges her physical C for a C prime with another agent. And this happens more complexly, the way I described it, because the probability of all this stuff going off in C is quite small. I just did that to make the example a little more simple. And now imagine her back, she's ready to go. She's got one entire transformation cycle completed, and she's back trying to figure out how to get this state. Yeah.
Is there any guarantee that she gets a full C prime for her C? I know that, like, that's what she measured it to be.
Oh, the agents decide that amongst themselves. I'll come to that. There's bid ask.
Okay.
Right, so let me see if I understand the key point. The key point here is you have stuff. A, B, C, D, okay. And everybody knows what stuff is, and a B is a B, and a C is a C,
yeah.
And they are trading around stuff. But they're not really keeping track of stuff, which is real physical stuff. They have, if I may, little pieces of paper with pictures of the stuff on it.
Right.
Right. And so this is what you mean by value. So they have a certain
right.
amount of stuff, and being in a certain state entitles them to have certain pieces of paper with things. With pictures of stuff written on it. And there are some set of rules, which I don't remember, but maybe this is not the point, by which relate the pieces of paper with pictures they have to the stuff they have.
Right.
And then the key thing is that when the agents interact, so it would be particle physics as we know, without the little pictures, okay, it would be stuff that we do in particle physics. A certain amount of stuff is conserved, is being exchanged. what makes it novel for us is that the two things are going on simultaneously.
Right. The change in the pictures. Because we exchange pairs. No exchange happens that doesn't involve at least a major and a physical object.
So she wants a bee, so she gives back a little piece of paper with a picture of C prime on it.
Right.
And he can choose to take it or not take it. If he doesn't take it, there's no exchange and she doesn't get the bee.
Right.
If he takes it, he puts it in his little pile.
Right.
Okay. And then the accounting thing, the thing that is a kind of like a conservation law, is that the amount of stuff plus pictures of stuff has to add up and have to get that in each of their.
Right. The units that we're trading, the papers and the pictures on them that you can exchange versus the idea that you can measure everything with, are constrained, but as they explore these currencies and collisions and move to common currencies, those currencies which are common have more pictures on them. So when Bingo started, she's got a bill, you know, with an A, B, and a C on it, because it represents their transformation possibility, or maybe if you think of the individual state, it's just an A on it, and other picture maybe, and other things. If a lot of people start using C, it causes there to be more exchangeable units of C, and now C has a lot of particle pictures on it. When you get to a common currency, you know, it might start to be three pages of pictures.
So, roughly speaking, the hypothesis is if you set this up with simple rules, it evolves to a state where they all agree about what they exchange.
Right.
And they all agree about how they value other things.
Well, they don't all agree. They clump into currency communities.
All these models.
So they clump into the exact kind of currencies you saw in those, when I said the currencies of the world lie on a power law distribution. So you get currency communities with power law distribution of agents inside the currency community, and you get one, you might get one for C prime if it was going like this, and you might get some others. And I'll show you the dynamic of how that happens in just a couple of slides. I'm almost to that point. So Bingo's done a transformation cycle now, and she's in this non-physical state, but she's got 1.1 pieces of paper with a C on it. But the C is a proxy for all three particles she measured.
Right.
Okay. And the further up this chain you go, as you get to a common currency, the more it's a proxy for everything. Okay. So she just does one more set of arithmetic. And this in C prime, she got another one. She started with 0.1, so she has 1.1 now. She had an inventory, we used to call it a 0.9. She gave it away, so she doesn't have any of that. And she can also compute the change in her state between due to a single transformation cycle. So if I do it in units of the paper with a picture, she got 1, she gave up 9, she made 0.1. And if I use it in purest major, she's at state 1.1 now, she started at 1, so she's up by 0.1. And these two always give you the same answer. And this is how you get complete. Now she can have a full analyst call. Because she's got what accountants call a balance sheet, cash and equity, and a little income statement of, you know, 1 minus 0.9 equals 1. And the first one is where she is now. I think in science you guys would be more inclined to call it a location than a balance sheet. And the second is the sum of the transformations is effectively a vector in this space. So she's in space in terms of C, 1.1, and we have a little vector that shows us how she got there from state
1.0. Hmm. The valuation that she gave into A and B, the 0.5 and 0.5, is that a function of her location, of her vector, or is it just an initial condition that stays?
Just an initial random starting point.
Okay, so that doesn't change.
I'll show you how that works in three slides.
Okay,
and this is the same thing, 5,000 years old, da 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 da. And this is a little, this is an interesting little thing. It's a 2x2 matrix that. If you don't explode into a bunch of detail in any one of the four cells, you can always collapse this little process that I've described, irrespective of the complexity, into this little 2x2 matrix. The more you collapse it, the less detailed information you might have about it. But you can collapse any economic entity that we know of into this 2x2 matrix. And it's not particularly hard to do. And that's, and then if you put in a counting word, I mean, this in case of bingos is kind of my years and up, you know, in the past. This is kind of the timeline here in the middle, and then the balance sheet is the stuff for later. And two by two is as big as it needs to get. Sawhill said it should be called Heisen equity because it collapses in another paradox, because we go mine yours, except mine is mine down in the bottom right hand corner. But, you know, we're comfortable this is a paradox anyway now. And this goes on out over time, and so the cells might get filled up. But a nice thing about the construct is, since that number that's so paradoxical in the bottom right hand keeps track from wherever you started to wherever you end up, you know, with a single number, as data in these things gets older and less interesting to look at, you can clip it off, you know, so you can keep your computational density down to a manageable level. So it's a very practical little construct. And we call that who by when, or, but it's essentially just a little transaction matrix. Very simple arithmetic. Okay, I would say it's a practical number. This has been used for 5,000 years. It's used in every country, regardless of the political, social, economic, philosophical environment, and it's used in exactly the same way. Okay, now let's do Max. He was computing in terms of B prime, and he didn't know about C until bingo, but after bingo, he can think for himself about what that might mean to him. He had been thinking 0.4 plus 0.6 equals 1, and B prime and Q over P is 1.5, and so forth. And bingo says it's 1B over B equals 0.C over B. And first experience with bingo, he's programmed to trust and take a look at new information. So he goes, okay, that must mean that I just multiply, you know, by 0.4, and I get 0.16 plus 0.24. So it's just like simple arithmetic, okay? So in effect, Max has a little starting state value matrix, which we call this what by what not. So there's like this what's over there, PQB, and what not's across the top, the primes. And we just did this arithmetic, and so we put it in a little matrix, and we know the diagonal is ones, and we know the stuff on the bottom is the same as the stuff on the top, flipped upside down, and so forth. And then that was his starting state. So this is like an untested value hypothesis before he's had one single experience in a collider. The next thing that happens, bingo comes along, and so now he needs to add a row and a column, which we do, and we put in the 0.4 there, and that has been empirically tested, but it's a pair that's been tested. So he can only test these things in pairs. He can't test a single data item like this in this exchange. And here's where a funny thing happens on the way to the form, because I colored the yellow ones empirical, and I colored the blue ones the stuff that we computed. But if you think about thinking about how empirical it is versus empirical, not empirical, you could argue that the 0.4, you could give it a 1 score for empirical, not, that means tested. And 0 means not tested, no experiments. Well, you've got a little bit of a problem here, because we were testing a pair. It is conceivable, and I'm looking back now, not forward. It is conceivable. He doesn't know how much experience Bingo had versus how much experience he's had. That's not disclosed to him in the exchange process. So in effect, looking back, you could say that that's sort of like partially tested. She doesn't know that for sure, but you could think that way. And you could even think that maybe this had a value between 0 and 1. We got distracted here for about a year before we decided we needed to go back and get back to run the model and see if we could get the kinds of probabilities and uncertainties that you see out in the real world to emerge from the model rather than trying to put them in. Because we were thinking, boy, maybe we need to teach Bingo how to think about these values out there. It turned out we didn't have to in the minimum case, but maybe we could later. And so now just imagine what's happening dynamically in this little value matrix over time. I'm just going to brush this. It gets bigger, you know, each time we have a new experience here. These little empirical occurrences happen out over time, bumping into a bunch of variants in the model, and we constrain it a little bit with a parameter, and I'll confess the parameters here in a couple more slides. you get a bunch of variation out there, and you're recomputing as you go along, and it, you know, there are other tests. So, you know, Max might test in B prime. It might test other currencies, depending randomly on what happens. And in the process, if you think of this value hypothesis matrix like a big Rubik's Cube, you get little clumps of reduced certainty about what's already happened as the currencies collapse into commonality. Or I don't know if collapse is the right word, but that's essentially what you see looking in there when you actually run this, which is kind of a cool thing. Okay, so so we have two matrices. I'm now just summarizing the agent stuff. The transaction one, 2x2, nice little collapser. Can put a lot of stuff in there, but still reduce it to the simplest construct. And the value one doesn't behave as well because it explodes, but it's nice and parsimonious cell by cell. And since an agent can say yes or no, another interesting thing happens. The state of empirical knowledge in the value matrix expands even in transactions that don't end up in a trade. So if an agent says to Bingo, here's the deal, this is good enough for me, and Bingo says no, she still knows it was good enough for them, so she can put it in her value matrix, and it hardens up some areas of uncertainty and is helpful in that way. So the rate at which uncertainty is diminished in the Rubik cube or the value matrix is actually accelerated by dint of the fact that both yeses and noes have good information, and it is complicated by dint of the fact that every empirical test is a pair. Okay, so now I would just say a word about Hagel. I mean, up until now, this little model was just like dead. So, we are closing in on simplicity here. And so the first thing we did was cheat. He asked me about when we cheated, and we probably cheated two or three times, and maybe I had some of the axes wrong, and we certainly cheated here, because the first thing we did was we appointed a broker to intervene between the agents so we could test the model. And we just had him look at both agents and select the currency that was known to at least one and computed if they could trade it at any advantage at all or not. And if they could, we split the difference and had them do it. And they exchanged all the information and units. And this just went like bang. Just went bang to the currency and the economic agent power laws. But of course, the problem was, ooh, that's not very good science. That's just cheap. So, and we went back. We were pretty sure we were going to do some iteration of tit for tat because, you guys know what that is? Most everybody in the room? Well, there's a huge amount of empirical evidence for this little tit for tat program, particularly in complexity science and biology. It's the only one that ever beats the prisoner's paradox. The biologists think that it's probably a minimum condition for adaptive evolution and biology and so forth. So there's a ton of fabulous work done on it. And we were pretty sure something that looked like tit for tat would be a place to start to try to make this run. And so we had a little cooperation if-then sequence, cooperate, trust in effect, like Max did Bingo, and then compute good or bad, and then if it's good, do it over, and go back, use a stiff along your foramic pointer, and if it's bad, then don't. But this thing branches immediately. It branches on the yes, no, and then each time on each yes and no, there's a pair involved, so it branches on the pairs, so it starts to explode here. Something starts to get big in your hands when you're trying to do the exchange piece. And I'll show you how we hacked our way through the explosion problem in a second, but the computing good or bad and how about yes or no is pretty easy now because the agent has this little model that they can use, and just for whatever the next particle is, they can look at the proposed value, do the computation, and see if they're winning or losing by taking that step. So they can compute good or bad, and hence if they're on the answering end of the exchange, they can compute yes or no very simply. Keep in mind it's a rolling test. They only test one particle at a time, so they're always in a hypothetical state. And How about's a little more complex, because if they want to raise, there's like a virtually closing in on infinite number of possible numbers they could raise by. And what we did to constrain that is use the tick size increment. And if I have time to get to it, I'll tell you about tick size, because we've done another model on that for the NASDAQ market. So we kind of had an idea where the tick size range might work at least.
Is it possible, like, did you guys end up having some agents that were bad agents, as in the end, they realize, like, if you're an agent and you have some transformation, and the net effect of your transformation, that your transformation loses you value, because you could technically resale your A for more and your B for more, and no one values C, and so converting your A and B to C is a loss.
Well, only way nobody values the one, since everybody's using some piece of this physical universe, is if some of them have mortality events, and then that sprinkles through and kills other agents. We didn't put in any fancy evil, try to do bad things, try to screw the other agents kind of stuff, because the tit-for-tat guys have done 20 years of fabulous science, basically showing those mostly exploded, and so we didn't feel like we needed to go back and replicate that.
But wouldn't it be kind of realistic to have agents in there who, you know, every now and then take some, you know, they take some steel and some rubber and stuff and make an Edsel?
Yeah.
And nobody buys it, and yeah, they just die out.
Maybe. If I have time, I'm going to tell you a model that we built to predict, not to hypothesize. And the short answer to that is that strategies, like everything else in here, tend to rely on power law distributions, 80-20 rules. So when we did the NASDAQ market, for example, we got about 85 or 90% of the trading strategies we could collapse into six basic fundamental strategies and a little tail that did the rest. So we only wanted to do enough here to see if we could produce power laws with some rough sort of exchange mechanism, and we wanted to try four or five and see if they all produce similar patterns. And then if you're going to turn this to predictive modeling, you would look at the part of the world you're looking at, take advantage of power law, hypothesize the trading strategies, and take a shortcut around all the branching problems that happen from any of those exchange strategies.
So just in terms of time, since I'm in the chair, so if the formal part could be 15 more minutes.
Okay.
You're giving us a lot of detail. And
okay.
So, but I know that there's a lot more that you want to talk about.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Let me zoom past that.
Some of us will stay for a long time for chat.
That's great. So we did a bid-ask sequence, and just to give you flavor to stuff, the minimum you got a 2x2 is 4, and as soon as you have a counter, then you have 3 possibilities for each branch, so you've got 6 counting the pairs at each successive step. So it goes, you know, 6 times 6 is 36 times 6, so the thing just explodes in your hands if you don't keep the... If you don't, you know, keep this, you know, fairly simple. And we actually didn't have a big enough computer to run a 3-step bid-ask cycle, so we moved it up to actually 5 if you count the coin flip for start. And then we took a bunch of branches out of that cycle and lopped them off, just took them out as a possibility so that the computer could run. And we lopped off different ones kind of randomly in three or four experiments. And in most of those situations, we got similar power law patterns. So we can come back and untangle this later. And here are the main parameters. We had a mortality parameter, so the agent had a certain time to live. If they didn't finish metabolism sequence in that time, they died. We had a tolerance mortality gradient, so they might think good as break even when they have a long time to go, and then they'd accept more and more losses, and then they'd take anything to metabolize that they could trade for right before they died. We did the Paromic pointers I mentioned. We used a little credit parameter, which extends mortality, and this is where you pass over time, because now we're not conserving the papers with the pictures on them. We're using future papers. And we had to extend the bid-ask cycles. And we used tick sizes that we learned would work when we were building models for the NASDAQ market. And they happened to be between 3 and 7% works great. And so there's the simplest hypothesis we could get to. You know, it ain't perfect. It could be simplified further. But it's a lot less complicated than most of what you see in these models. Take Solis from Einstein. Simple as possible, not simpler. And so here's the picture, the little agents, they have this little matrix with the empirical in and out. They got a little knowledge cloud, the little clumps in the value matrix that's out there. And I just threw down a power law to remind you what it looked like, and Harriet's got zillions of these under different model runs. But we got nice currency power law distributions. This is transaction volume by currency candidates. And inside each currency, we got nice power law distributions of agents measured in terms of their equity on this landscape. And this is like, it's sort of cool. It's, in biology, they use fitness landscapes all the time, but they have a seminal event called BEF, and so they basically define them in terms of your with us or not. And, you know, actually, if you you can look at your agents here in terms of progress and whether they're getting better or worse, you don't have to wait for them to die to announce them into the experiment, so that was cool. And so now let me tell you this other little short story in 10 minutes. Okay. Now I'm going to, so that was a theoretical model. Could you get it simple? I think, I'm hoping you accept that it's possible to get it a lot simpler. And it's about physical systems. It isn't about all this other theoretical stuff that we listen to in the news. Now, go back to 1998, and I was chairman of the NASDAQ market, and we had this big political crisis going on about what minimum tick size should be. In the market, tick size is how much you have to change the bid to bid. And for 150 years, the minimum tick size had been a 16th. And you might go, why a 16th? And the answer was because the Brits started it and they used 16th.
And a 16th of a dollar?
A 16th of a dollar. And they were called teens. The minimum tick size was a teen. That was the way we talked about this on Wall Street. And Congress and others were like, this is the most ridiculous, backward, awful thing I've ever heard. We should use decimals. Failure to use decimals simply shows we're entirely resistant to progress, and there's no significant difference between dividing by 16 and dividing by 100 in here. Political landscape, the newspapers, the drumbeats of Congress. So I went to see Lee and Stu and Bios and stuff, and I'd never built one of these models before, but I've been hanging around with them, and I met these guys, Sasha Utkin and Vince Darley, and I hired them to build an agent model to tell me what would happen in NASDAQ if we changed from teens to decimals. And about 4 months ago, they published a fabulous little book, and if anybody's interested in them, I can probably get them for you, called the NASDAQ Market Simulation, that describes their work. And it's a very scientific book, unlike my sort of hokey pass through this model here this afternoon. And they made these predictions. I'll put them up here and then explain them. Six. The first was that doing this would negatively impact price discovery. Price discovery is if you're a trader on Wall Street and you see a displayed price, does it really include the last real price that you'd like to be thinking about after allowing for all the different latencies and the way data flows around in the marketplace? And so if you go back later and look when everything started versus when this guy got sucked, there may be a bunch of stuff that's not there in the number that he's looking at because it didn't make it there with the time he needed to make the trade. And you know, this is called price discovery. The model predicted decimalization would negatively impact price discovery, make it worse. The probability that the number the trader saw, the trade against, the bid or raise against, would go down, that was representative of everything that had started in that same instant in time was actually there for him to look at when it occurred. Second.
So roughly speaking, price discovery is better when the fluctuations in the prices of things are smaller?
It's just actually better when the flow of the price information is seamless across all of the number of systems that are working. And actually, the truth is, the more complex and the more paths there are, the more latency there is, and the more price discovery tends to erode. So intuitively, it's not a hard conclusion if you believe that it was going to increase trading volume to imagine that it was going to decrease price discovery. Two should have been one. They predicted that trading volume would increase and perhaps increase dramatically. Trading volume is just share trade predictor. They predicted that investor wealth, by which I mean long-term investors, which on Wall Street is like 10 or 12 days, would be disadvantaged, perhaps significantly. They predicted that phase transitions would occur in the trading community, and they predicted that quote clustering would increase, which is what politically killed it. So here's what quote clustering was. In between the bid-ask spread, if you look back at what happened in the market, the quotes did not clump around the median. They were non-Gaussian in between in the bid-ask spread. And this, in 1998, was considered prima facie evidence of collusion by traders because it was non-Gaussian. And this was widely accepted politically, and the Justice Department and the Securities Exchange Commission were on a major Salem trip, and there were about 250 traders that were being investigated. Some of them were put in jail, and they were just on a rage to prosecute these guys for collusion. And there were one or two of them that were slime balls too. And so when we built an agent model where the agents couldn't cheat, that showed this major policy they were screaming for, would cause even more non-Gaussian distribution of quote clustering, and they were predisposed to tell us to buzz off. And then they predicted that parasitic strategies would become more effective. Okay. So we went about it and went through all of this, but the Brookings thing had just happened. Greenspan said you couldn't model this stuff. He weighed in. Don't listen to these modelers. I testified to Congress. I went nuts with the NASDAQ guys trying to give this model to the regulators and say, I'm not telling you to do decimals or teenies or anything else. I'm just saying, please. It's got a slider bar on it. You could, this model had a slider bar. You could go, you know, divide by 100, 98, 97, 96. You could go all the way up to 16 and back.
Did you optimize?
What? You could have, well, yeah. Every single step you took from 16 made it worse. So anyway,
you could have to 10 or what you thought.
What if you 10
or 5 or
something? I would have just taken anything in the middle, you know. But if I ever have to do it again, I'll do it with you guys and we'll do better. So here's what happened in 2001. After the dot-com bomb, NASDAQ hired another independent economic group. So this is not Vincent, Sasha, to do a study of what happened in the wake of decimalization. Price discovery eroded. Volume increased dramatically in the dot-com bomb and then just exploded and dropped dramatically. There was a huge phase transition. I'm not saying this is the only reason, but it was an accelerant on a big fire that was already underway. Investor wealth on the long-only desk increased, and there was a sharp decline in the percentage of household net worth represented by stocks and investments versus real estate. And it's hard to tell which was because of real estate going up and which because of the other way. But just at the long-only desk, wealth decreased substantially. These guys said there was only ambiguous support for phase transitions in market strategies as long as you ignore algorithms. In 1998, you looked at market volume, you know, it went the long only guys, short guys, then the 40% depending on the day, and then there was a 45%, and there was like a 10% other. That's how we looked at the market. Today, when you look at it, you got in the high 30s, you got long only, you got the short guys, and you got the algos just a touch below them. In less than 8 years. If you leave out the algos, they found ambiguous support for phase transitions and market strategy. Quote clustering increased dramatically. And the government announced, well, we've caught all the bad guys we could catch, and this is a complex thing. Nobody can explain it anyway, and quote clustering seems to be up for reasons that no mortal could possibly predict. And parasitic traders gained, and that's what's called hedge funds. Now, what you read about in almost daily in the newspapers. So I scored as Darley Adkin 5-6 based on the NASDAQ study. And personally, but I'm prejudiced, I'm inclined to give them at least a 0.9 on these predictions. I go regulator 0. So back to the website. While much of what Orl says about weather economics is profound, he goes on to point out the biggest problem they have in weather is clouds. That's where the complexity explodes in their hands. Looking at these clouds, and the clouds don't keep books. You can't go to a cloud and say, hey, stop the music for a minute and show me exactly what you've done, where you've been for the last 3 months. But economic entities do, all firms do, and it can be easily reconstructed for individuals. And so I say economists have much better bottom-up data to work with, and they'd still do a worse job than weather guys. I'll do this very briefly. You may think that the transformation functions that you would need to use to model real companies in the real world are incredibly complex. My personal experience has been the opposite. So we used to laugh at Microsoft, say, how do you make software? You take Coke and pizza and developers and put them in a room, and out comes software multiplied by prices. It goes to the customers. We had two major products. That was a Microsoft business model for all the buildings and stuff. The transformation equation for the most valuable company in the marketplace was dead nuts simple. And it is for most big businesses and small businesses I've been associated with. And what great managements do is simplify transformation. And what bad managements do is let it get too complicated so that it couldn't be modeled. And they go out of business anyway, so you don't have to model it for very long because they disappear. So I think there's huge opportunity here to do way better economic modeling around this notion of agents and transformation steps. Yes.
Did you find proof for that? If you had someone whose transformation was seven inputs to like one output, did they die more often?
I don't know if I could be that empirical, but I'll tell you my personal instinct is, you know, okay. Every time we fix things, we made them simpler, and every time we screwed it up, we did something we didn't think about carefully that made things unnecessarily complicated. And there may be exceptions to that. That's an intuition. I'm not offering that as an empirical observation. And there's one final thing we can do in economics that's very hard in weather. We can parse by abstraction layer in these things. So let me just whiz through this. I got 2 minutes, I guess. So when we talked about practical money, and we took only two abstraction steps from a physical particle to give ourselves a practical form of money that emerged and looked like power laws. That was two steps. Now, abstract bingo. And give her New York Stock Exchange symbol B and trade her shares of stock on New York, and now you have abstracted a transformation statement. Add all those up and all the public exchanges in the world, and the total public equities at last tick, value only, no adjective, is about $13 trillion. Take the direct, now abstract bingo again. You've got B, warrants, puts, calls, straps, straddles, and other derivatives. Abstract those. Add up the open derivatives positions at the end of the market, divide by two because there's a position on each side, and that number runs 10 to 12 times the value of the underlying derivatives. You can abstract collections of transformations and call them stocks. That's what the NASDAQ 100 is, for example, when it trades. You can abstract from the primes. And we have debt derivatives, and debt derivative clouds are similar in magnitude in comparison to the underlying debt. And the same thing is true in currencies. And we should be good enough at arithmetic to keep track of what abstraction layer we're in. And abstractions are parameters of policy, and those policies can be changed. There were very few derivatives back before a major lawsuit that held that Wall Street firms should be free to issue derivatives of securities for underlying issuers. The issuers took it to court and said, wait a minute, we're responsible for this. Everything, every value this has is based on what we do down here. We'd like to say whether to get issued or not. Went to the court. Court said, nope, that wouldn't be a free market. Go for the derivative. So there's huge abstraction clouds out there, which we're trying to look down through to figure out, you know, why we're running out of oil and that sort of stuff. So I just say sustainability and global warming are physical problems. Politicians and economists respond with belief-based solutions. I'm being rude. And heuristic solutions, which are better than belief-based. And I'm saying if we can work with particles and waves, then surely we can approach economics in terms of physical and value. It's time to try to build better models. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. That was good. Why don't we let people go who want to run, and then we'll continue just in a formal discussion. And Mike is here into pub night, so we're going to just hang out and be chatting. But let's take questions for a few minutes, and then we'll just hang out in a formal. Steve?
How do you deal with, wealth creation in these kind of models? They look to me like you're sort of you had zero-sum game set up. That's what the conservation law is all about.
The great thing about modeling, if you do the arithmetic at the agent level, as I've suggested here, which is not done, is we can not only add up aggregate wealth, because the way they do it now is they add it up, and then they try to, after they get to the total, they look back and try to figure out like where it is and who has it and stuff like this. If you do this by agent, then you can not only tell how much there is, but you can see which classes of agents were advantaged and which were disadvantaged. So you not only have the aggregates, you have the ability to disaggregate in a fairly orderly way. Now, you know, when you do build agent models, you basically have agent hypotheses, and they're not perfect representations because you're trying to simplify things as much as you can. But in my experience, they often sorts to a short list because the thing you're looking at is a power law. So there were six trading strategies that built this model, which was quite predictive. The one we built for the air taxi in Florida, we had 10 agent categories.
What were you trying to model?
We were modeling transportation in the southeast region
usage
of the United States. Yeah, Jim and Bruce built a model. It took about 5 years. I think it's the biggest one in the transportation model in the private sector. And here's how good their model is. We use this to go to people to see if they want to fly on the jet. And the agents, they built the model and then they tested it for 3 or 4 years to see if it predicted what actually happened without the little jets in. So this has got a lot of parameter wedges and stuff jammed in here and there to keep it tuned so it looks like history did. And then they predicted demand for jet trips. And then they correlated where the demand was coming from hypothetically with where companies were located. They got very high correlation. And then they actually print out a little thing for our sales guys. And so we've been going into companies and we would go in and have an experience like this, we'll say, our model shows that you guys had 26 guys that traveled last year taking an average of 6 trips. And we're getting responses now like, no, it's not 26, it's 34. Average was 7. Not perfect, but very, very useful. And if you go to investors, they're easier to convince about this stuff than politicians. You know, we raised a couple $100 million to start this whole airline. And those guys love the model because you don't really show them how it works. You go, they go, oh, it must be valuable. But if you take really good stuff, you know, into the public sector and say, hey, this is a good idea. How about this? They go, eh. But anyway, that's the, I don't know if that's a good answer to your question. Or
well, I'm not sure it was interesting. The direction I was going is you seem to be interested in problems that involve finite resources. So, I mean, one of the things, one of the things that happens is you have an increase in the number of agents over time. That's what you use for resources. And then access to resources is partly driven, which is, I'm thinking, sort of the size of your total pool here, by cost and demand. I mean, there's oil and land, the cost, the deeper it is, the more it costs to get. So I'm just wondering how that
could model it. Okay, well, let's take the two examples of resources. Take compute resources first. Early in my career in the software business, I learned a very valuable lesson from a wily old database developer named Dave Fulton, who invented Fox Software. And they had great database code, and with Microsoft, we had crappy, inefficient database code. And I was sent to buy Fox to see if we could clean ourselves up, which I did. And I said, Dave, what is the secret to writing so much tighter code than my guys write? And he says, give them crappy computers. He says, if you give them good computers, they just waste compute cycle. He says, if you give them crappy computers, then they have to be ontologically parsimonious. Is that right? And so to some extent, I think there's an element of that to some extent in this. We built this huge transportation model and we built it on three blade servers. We had to do some stuff to speed them up, so we took all the operating system crap and everything else out of there and wrote our own stuff and just went straight to the chip, and so we didn't waste a bunch of stuff, you know, going in directions that wasn't what we wanted to do. And we built a model on those blade servers, a heuristic model for real-time routing, and we benchmark against Georgia Tech, which has the big Cray and does that work for FedEx and UPS, and we can run at 96-97% of their solution, their overnight 24-hour solution in 3 seconds on little blade servers. So I'm not saying there's a solution to anything like that, to any one model that you might want to build, but I think you just have to look at that problem on model-by-model basis, and I'm more optimistic about it than some others are, you know, in my experience. It didn't take a huge amount of compute cycles to simulate the NASDAQ, and it took almost none to do this little conceptual model. I told you we ran that on a standard HP laptop, and model runs were defined as one or two pizzas and no more than two bottles of wine, and then no matter where we were, we go back and look again to see if we had a power law. So that's sort of on the physical constraint. Okay, just dream for a second. Imagine building a model around physical constraints. Pick energy. That is one. And so you go, okay, well, I got to build some agents that look like the energy firms up in the Arctic. Well, it's a big power law. There's six monsters, you know, and you probably had probably three classes of agents or four, something like that. You could probably pretty much make them look like the energy industry does. And they say, no, what else do I need? Oh, I need gas stations. Well, there's zillions of those, but mostly a lot of them do the same thing, you know, and you might leave out the mini mark to simplify it if you weren't interested in the sandwiches at that minute. And so, you know, you don't have to build that many agents, you just kind of look where the gas stations are and sprinkler agents out there in the same place, the same ratios, and tune things up a little bit until you're pumping about the same amount of computational gas as they're pumping. And so I don't think those are beyond the reach of discipline science. I'm not a disciplined scientist, my own self, but it seems to me like working at that in collaborative ways, we should be able to do that better. Now, if you could build such a model, either for a small country that would contain computational problems a little bit and test it, or for a portion of the economy, and you could put some borders around it so you didn't explode out of those borders, then you could talk about useful kinds of parametric adjustments, because you could turn down a flow of gas or oil, barrels of oil, you could turn it up, you could change the tax rates. Somebody could say, here's another way to incent this or not incent it on the landscape, so you could put that slider bar on your dashboard and move it. And while the results wouldn't be perfect, you may find, as we did in the NASDAQ case, that there's one or two of those parameters that are very finely tuned. You know, if you wiggle the slider bar, all kinds of weird stuff happens. You get classes of agents, you know, with mortality events and stuff, and you may find large tolerance to the slider bar in other places that aren't really hurting these guys as much, and you still may have to make trade-off decisions. But to me, that's an intelligent way to go about looking at trade-offs. I don't think you change political behavior, but I think you can affect the questions that they answer with science. So you say, hey, it's not my problem, you know, who we're helping and who we're screwing here, that's up to you guys. But if you were interested in how much you're helping the ones you're helping and how much you're screwing the ones you're screwing, try my slider bar.
This ties into the questions of global warming. So one way to handle it is to do have finite resources, but then also there's, so you just externally impose your limitations and move your slider bar around. But the other question is, how much damage are you doing?
Right.
So can you build in that minus sign into the system? So
sure. Well, these guys get hurt. I mean, these agents go up, they lose money, they don't know how to lose money, you know. And most of the way, when you're intervening with policy, one of the ways you intervene is in the exchange place where it gets branches complexity anyway. And that's, you know, it's called price rules and bid rules and exchange rules. So not all the rules we live with are are.
Well, so I guess I'm asking how you build that in. Let's say you and I make a tray, which puts up a lot of CO2, but that's not built into the small picture because it's not obvious. We're not hurting each other. We're just.
I think you would build that into the landscape, and you could build it into the transformation equation. If I'm transforming a certain way and it kicks out so much CO2, just give me a little CO2 cloud that goes with me and just measure the CO2, you know, rather than, you know, trying to rechange the economy and announce what everything should be worth to everybody, mm-hmm. go ahead and let people do what they're going to do anyway, because they do in every kind of political economy, economic
system.
Well,
that's what I meant, as opposed to imposing constraints from the outside, you can build it into every step.
Right. So we don't do a good job in this model with waste.
Yeah,
or with either constraint.
You could just negative value waste.
Right.
Of course you could.
You could add this in at every step.
But you don't even have to value that. Those are easy. You could measure those physical particles. You don't have to tangle it up with a value problem.
In other words, every time you get C, you also get CO2 or whatever.
Exactly.
You put icy.
Exactly. And you build a dashboard for this, you build a dashboard for this, and over here on this side.
So you haven't done this yet.
No. I'm saying this is the kind of thing that I believe should be start to be thought about if, as you know, intelligent people that reason together in scientific ways.
It's a purely economic problem, right? You don't have
to think. Yeah, it's a purely economic problem.
Yeah, you don't know.
Okay. Actually, it's sort of funny. I made two other exploratory visits to think about this because I promised my kids at dinner one night I'd think about it. One of them I did down in the Valley, you know, and I went to see the Sierra Club guys because I'm talking about they'd be interested in this kind of stuff. They were belligerently disinterested in anything that I couldn't already guarantee would produce the answers to the questions in the way they wanted to answer. And I talked to this, and then I, just to test how crazy the private industry guys were, I talked to this guy at Shell Oil who was actually very receptive, and I thought, well, you know, I don't think you can do this work well. Any place other than something with an academic kind of model, because you need to have scientists and, you know, the guys that you guys get that work on this kind of stuff, and postdocs, and discipline, and rigor, and leadership, and neutral, I think. But I think there are possibilities, so I'm kind of doing my, I'm a Johnny Appleson right now, and taking this little seed around and giving it away to see if it interests anybody. Yeah.
You talked about simple business models and financial transparency. Do you think there's enough, like outside of the modeling aspect, but do you think there's enough financial transparency across the world with regards to people knowing what other people are doing?
I showed you how simple it is to keep track of these agents. The government has always liked to be in charge of the quote-unquote rules for accounting. So there's a huge database with 400 or 500 pages of rules under each of 16,000 tags in the database on accounting rules, and the current trend is to push future values and hypothetical values and abstractions and stuff into the transaction model I showed you, and obscure at the level of the enterprise, the physicality of the enterprise, just as it's obscured in the macro economy by these abstraction layers that are out there, which is, in my own personal view, is going exactly the wrong direction, but they have a full head of steam. So, you know, I think probably expect that to happen for a while, but it's not a productive use of one's time to change one of these, you know, philosophical campaigns when they're on the warpath, you know.
Because, you know, under being an accountant, everyone, you know, we're moving towards international standards, you'd think that you'd have more transparency moving that way, but there's more complexity coming
in, derivatives and financial. It's a terrible landscape. They have this stuff they call GAAP now, generally accepted accounting principles. And you can't figure out the value of the company using this for yourself if somebody else has put it in value they think is the company in without getting their stuff out. And so you have this vastly complex landscape where the big private equity firms like Blackstone and stuff like that specialize in you know, having the predatory guys that flourished after the tick size squash attack the companies, the value goes down, they take all the cap stuff out, figure out what's actually happening, buy them cheap, announce that they've cleaned everything up, and then take it back out public and probably 1 or 2 years later and take pocket vast sums of money, and they're, you know, totally in codes with the regulators. So that process is not, you know, a particularly efficient place to insert oneself by way of intervention. But predictive models that are very useful that deal with the groundswell of concern about oil, water, food, and global warming are, I believe, a good place to focus, because I think, you know, we may not be as focused on it as we should be now, but if we don't get focused on it pretty soon, we're going to be really focused on it. And it's too late, you know, when the disasters are occurring, to say, geez, it would have been nice to build a tool here to work on this just so we could tell what the hell to do. You have to start the tool early. Yeah.
You said that you had the 6 necessary parameters that you had to put in, and one was your Fermi pointers, right? If you take just that out, does everything collapse?
I don't know.
Because I
didn't test all
the
iterations.
Okay, it's very strong kind of indication that learning is necessary for economic, because that's essentially adding a human learning.
I didn't test that.
Okay.
There's a lot of ways you could test this far more rigorously. You have to work at it. We didn't really work at this. We took about 3 years, but we only met like, you know, once every 3 or 4 weeks, and usually on a weekend. And, you know, it was a very sort of, this was a hobby experiment that we conducted. It was not a rigorous scientific experiment. It was an absolute ton of fun, but it was maybe the most interesting thing I've ever done in my life, but it wasn't rigorous. And I think if somebody could figure out, go very carefully through this and, you know, collapse into an equation or two what's going on with these abstraction layers, that would be a huge key, maybe one of the major contributions to economics ever. It might be,
Mark, so I like the way you frame the problem, but it seems to me that intelligence, you know, how smart the agency is, and that you're now getting into this kind of a model. So when you try it, all you think is that when you aggregate these, it really doesn't matter. I started Facebook before, and then I moved to economics and finance, and the common question I get is, I always think of each investor as a molecule or maybe behavior, and then at micro level, you cannot see, you know, the predictive behavioral pattern. But at macro level, you may be able to see the pattern. And then the common question that is very difficult to define is, well, the economic agent is a strategic behavior. They're very smart. They either make the move or they don't make the move. It's not like a molecular certain status you have to fit it into the mechanically way or condition or that stuff. How do you think that this kind of thing, like, you know, reflected in your model?
I think two things about it. First of all, I think that in terms of physical realities, if you have to eat, for example, if you have to do your own metabolism, pretty much have to, it doesn't really matter whether you're dumb or smart. I mean, everybody on here, no matter what their IQ is, needs to eat. I could be the smartest guy in the world, doesn't change that. And I can be the world's biggest boar, need to eat. So I think the closer you get back to the mandatory physical things, the less that matters. And then I'll take the extreme opposite side of that and take this, probably the highest IQ, smartest guys I bump into, you know, are traders on the street. And I'll tell you this story. Fred Fetterskill, who's another colleague at BIOS, runs a company in a pipeline in New York, which is a block trade company. So blocks are big bucks, big clumps of stock, you know. So technically a block's 10,000 shares. But to trade on this system, you have to have 100,000 or more at a time. So it's for the long only big guys. Oh, you do it in a dark vault, because the thing that the trader hates is if you have a large block and you go, here's a block for sale, you know, they go, oh, we're trying to get rid of it, down goes the price. You know, if you say, oh, I'd like to buy a block, up goes the price. So they do not like to be to signal to the market what they want to do. So the markets actually work better with less information because there's more trust. So in this system, it's a vault for block trades. And the problem with Vault for Black Trades is if you, because you'd like to cross it inside a black box, that, you know, you might have a 400,000 shares on one side and 300,000 on the other, but the 400,000 guy only wants you to do 400,000 or nothing, and so they don't come in the same size. So you need a technique to build a virtual, to fill out and have a virtual block without being noticed in the market. So the way we do that is we have what's called an algorithm switching engine that builds virtual blocks, and it has what we discovered working with the traders and stuff was that we needed to leave 6 holes in this switching engine for them to plug in their favorite algorithms. And our switching engine needed to be able to make near-term predictions about how classes of algorithms work. And just like with the trading strategies pre-algo days that we did in the NASDAQ simulation model, it collapses into a handful, I think it's 8 or 9 major strategies for execution algorithms. I'm just talking execution algorithms. I'm not talking trading algorithms. That's a different situation. I don't have enough aggregate data to know how many of those there are because everybody keeps it secret. But I know quite a bit about trading algorithms. And then the engine switches back and forth. So based on a prediction of what the best thing to be doing is, and each time it switches, it looks like the trade shut off, and so it makes it essentially invisible, you're pulling a lock, and that's how you do that. So now these trading algorithms are better than the best broker, just like Big Blue beats Gary Kasparov, and they have actually done empirical tests. They get the most alpha macho Brooklyn bond trader that they can get, and he gets up at the screen and they turn on the algo pick trade, they do, and the algos just kick his butt every single time. He just can't do it that fast. And so even the algos, which you might argue in terms of the trading IQ, complex market trading strategies, IQ, are empirically beat the bond traders, they still seem to fall into a power law distribution where you can sort them down into the smaller number. So I'm saying if you're trying to take the economy part and you're looking at these power laws, make them your friend, not your enemy. Say, what can I do with these? To simplify things so that I can disassemble this like the physical system it is and construct a theoretical model of how this physical system actually works.
So is the power law distribution, in effect, the most recent drop of the market where everyone, all the hedge funds were basically going the same way?
And I ask me to speculate about the market I don't have a model for, which is so I'm no better than Greenspan.
But it just seemed like
I can do
it.
Some
just seemed like everybody in the hedge fund is just doing the exact same thing.
Well, what happened in the subprime meltdown was if some young physicists would write these equations down that parse the abstraction layers. It was an abstraction layer phenomenon because all these REITs and mortgage-backed securities and everything else started as bank loans, and then they abstracted a stock representing these things, and then they traded the stocks, and then they wrote derivatives on the stocks so they could hedge the stocks. They got out there, and they got out there, and they got out there, and they got further and further and further and further away from guys that were going to work every day trying to live in their house and their ability to continue to pay an increasing percentage of their income for a place to live. And eventually, at some level of complexity, and there's probably some natural law out there, some other bright young physicist is going to discover, where you can actually see these phase transitions occurring in those spaces, and it just went poof. And there's $200 billion out there that people were treating as if it was a real picture. It was actually associated with particles, but it was associated with abstractions of abstractions of abstractions of particles.
But listen, I mean, what's interesting to me about that was predicted for several years, right? I mean, there was numerous predictions that would happen. Maybe it was another bubble. What you might ask is, why didn't anybody make any money off that? In other words, why couldn't you bet? Why is there an inability? I'm assuming that it was difficult to bet in favor of collapses.
No, Casey.
Was he to buy a derivative on that?
Sure. I'm not sure I know the guy's name, but if nobody made any money on a major dislocation like that, I'd be totally surprised. I do know four out of six, quote unquote, guys that made nice money on that, but they don't exactly have names because they're equations.
Because
we were running six of them in the marketplace, trading real money, and two of them bit the wrong bait and just, were a disaster, and four of them bailed out and went short and did fabulous. So I don't have enough data to respond to your question with the factual.
Well, I'm actually just sort of, because I thought it was an interesting line of questioning, because this looks like a very anti-behavioral approach to economic modeling. In other words, it's very much against the kind of, maybe I'm wrong, but the way the behavioral economists would think. And you might think that a bubble is the classic thing that you would use in sort of this group kind of lending behavior to be modeled by a behavioral economist. And so what I'm trying to do right now is to get a picture on how it comes out of your kind of model.
I'm not arguing against behavioral economics. I'm arguing
for... Well, then the interesting thing is how do they work together?
I'm arguing for ants. If you have a physical system that you understand and look at in terms of abstraction. So I'm not arguing against abstraction because I think they do a huge amount to reduce volatility in the layer underneath and all of those kinds of things. But I'm saying if, for example, you built economic models correctly based on the simple physical rules, and now you're at a complicated problem where you would like to understand behavioral alternatives, that you can use those as parameters for exchanges and actually test them. But if you simply start with behavioral economics explains everything, you don't put it in the context of the necessary physical systems of economics that have been running in essentially the same way for 5,000 to 7,000 years, then you lose context and you can find yourself on strange attractor paths that take you out into butterfly land.
So, Mark, we can make a prediction on the exchange on the market, but it's very difficult to make a prediction on the cross-sectional comparison of which kind of stocks should be falling, goes down, and what kind of the investors will
Sure. So. Anytime people ask economic questions and you're thinking about them theoretically, they always listen politely, and then they say, yeah, but tomorrow morning at the open, should I short Cisco with a $30 contract at 0.675 or not?
Yeah.
And you go, I don't know. If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be warming up to short Cisco at 26.75 if I thought I needed more money. That I probably wouldn't need it then, But if you start with the most fine point prediction that you could possibly desire, you go, what about that? I think you're going around it backwards. I think you want to start with, can I predict the most common things that where I have a non-starter if I can't get those? And then, when you're centered up on the patterns, you could say, okay, now I've got nice power law distribution matrices. Now I'd like to address the question of why it is that these guys are on the bottom and these guys are on the top. You know, this little thing I showed you, we were totally agnostic about who lived, who died, who went to the top, who was under the bottom, what happened to them. Public, well, I was kind of partial, but mostly we were totally agnostic. It's a separate problem, but if you can build a construct that gives you a pattern and then go back and go, now it'd be interesting to see what things we could adjust that would cause people to change places in the distribution. That would be interesting, and it would be hugely interesting to look at things that lifted the distribution up in the quadrant enough so that you relieved the misery at the bottom. You might not have to change the distribution, you just kind of lift bottom.
Yeah. So I'm coming back to currencies again. If you look at all the different world's currencies, and one thing you find at any given time is that a certain number of them will be experiencing a significant amount of inflation.
Correct.
At any given time. And many of them have moderate inflation, like the US and Western Europe, but then go elsewhere, you find more inflation, and in some places you find extreme inflation. So I was just curious if you gained any insight and how one might approach that. It seems to be
I think the entire focus on inflation, which is really, you know, post depression, that we learned that because after the depression, everybody thought there was just too much money and it was evil, and so they just shut it off and they just prolonged misery for like a long, long time. And the problem is to get actual measures of inflation. It's very complex to come at it from the top down, when the essence of it is you're trying to see if the quote-unquote money supply has gotten too many abstraction steps away from the underlying physical reality. And that is the fundamental question of inflation. And if you could model it as a physical system, more like physicists think and less like economists think, and triangulate that with the traditional measures of inflation, you might get some interesting ability to ask, you know, if those got way different, might have an interesting way to ask yourself whether the macro measures of inflation were in fact really solving the core problem, which is, do we have too many abstractions in here to get away from the goods and services? And when they count this, they're fairly casual about the abstraction steps that they've taken. And you know, you could think about inflation differently. Like we say now, inflation's not really that high, it's all under control. House prices, but you know, you have to have $1 million to buy a house, and you used to only cost $200,000 that took place in 6 years. So they take that out, the inflation matrix, and they say, don't count oil. And besides, everything's under control because, you know, OPEC happens to be keeping the price of oil low right now. Never mind that we're about to run out. And so you get some goofy, counterintuitive results between the physical and the abstract. And I think a disciplined model about how that had to be constructed, starting from the simplest case, would be a fabulous context in which to do this sort of thinking. But I haven't got any idea how to do much more than what I've done here, unless I hang around with guys that the only Greek letters I know are on the sorority houses in college.
Well, on this note, I think maybe it's pub night, and
yeah, let's go to a pub.
Have a beer.
Can I
just,
one thing? Thank you, guys. You want people to follow up on this? What are the resources? Is that NASDAQ study that just was published?
There's a book on that called A Market Simulation, I can give you some more pointers how to get that. Vince and Sasha would be thrilled if somebody bought the book. If you have a short list, I could buy some and send it to you or something. But and these guys are such fabulous guys, and they're so modest, and they're so scientific, and, you know, everything else. I mean, give me that model result and send me back to Congress, and they're going to hear loud noises, and I might not even be above theatricizing some of the results, you know, and they go, well, you know, but there's, well, they didn't. It's still down here and down here and down here and down here, which is what you play low. And
I hope they make some money off of that.
I don't make much money off the book, but I'm not sure they make money, guys. I think they're search for truth guys.
There's a difference.
There's a huge difference. Never be modest about being a search for truth guy. That stuff gets public.
Is there anybody get a copy of the code you used for this simulation?
From Jim Harriot. He'd love to talk to you about that.
Just because it looks like it would be fun to break things.
Everything we've done trying to do, everything else is out there for the
take.
Can we
get a software engineer?
A software engineer?
Yeah. Just so we have someone that we can play with this with.
I thought we have.
Yeah. If you guys I got like 4 or 5 more Johnny Appleseed trips in me. If you're interested in doing something and you want me to go find some collaborative software engineer that would in a position to do it. I'd be happy to try to help. I actually know my way around that a little bit. So, you know, so anyway, here's the seat. I don't know if it's real true or not.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.